Our next speaker is Professor Enrico Brunetti, who is a professor of infectious disease at the University of Pavia in Italy. And he will talk to us about his extensive experience and collaboration with the World Health Organization in the global management of high-dated disease, where things are right now, and what potentially could happen in the future.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman, for this nice introduction and for having me here. It's an honor for me, and especially for someone who's not a surgeon, I'm an infectious disease clinician. This is actually, the first time ever that I get an invitation by surgeons. So either this is, as I was saying earlier, a fluke, or is the beginning of understanding that this disease is so complex that we really need interdisciplinary approach. And while I recognize that there are, outside the liver, certainly the role for surgery is predominant. Within the liver, which, as you already heard, is the main location for, anatomical location for echinococcal cyst, we should work together because it's very difficult to understand, given the complexity of this disease, what is the best treatment. Actually, there is no best treatment. If you have to go case by case. The other point is that I'm not, given the quality of the previous presentation, it's very difficult for me to say something original, but the title of my presentation is "What Are the Contributions of the WHO Informal Working Group on Cystic Echinococcosis?" That I've been honored to be part for the last 20 plus years. And if I had to choose a single slide to represent the contribution of the WHO Informal Working Group, it would be this, which is basically the first standardized classification of echinococcal cyst seen on ultrasound. And it's basically, this is the brainchild of Professor Callum McPherson, who is a parasitologist, was the first parasitologist to use ultrasound for basically screening, mass screening of this condition. And he authored the seminal paper that was published in The Lancet in 1985, I think, and showed for the first time that ultrasound has much higher sensitivity and specificity for cystic echinococcosis than serology. Now, if you consider serology, the performance of serology, it's not difficult. And I'll show you why. So basically, this is the garbage classification that was mentioned in a previous presentations. And what was added was the subdivision of C3A and B as transitional cysts. And so basically you have on the left, CL is just diagnostic parking lot, so to speak. It's not a real stage. But C1 and C2 are the active cyst. C3 A and B, the subdivision came at a further stage, not when this classification was published. There are the transitional cysts, and then there are inactive cysts that are also called a pseudosolid with pseudosolid appearance. And this is a neat sort of distribution from a diagnostic and from a therapeutical point of view, because it allows you to choose the treatment. This is not the only criterion that we use, but it's certainly the most important. The other criteria are the dimension of the cyst and the absence or presence of complications. So if you take all these three criteria, you're almost all set to choose rationally your treatment. Now, why is this ultrasound? Because ultrasound is much better than the more modern and more sophisticated imaging techniques when it comes to staging the cyst. So this is a nice study done by the group in Heidelberg led by Thomas Jungens, and shows that this is the best case scenario and this is the worst case scenario. And in the worst case scenario, you may see easily as, for instance, CT scan do not allow to differentiate the cystic stages, bar maybe for C2 because you see the so-called septations. So these are the three main characteristics of this condition, and this is what makes so difficult to treat in a rational way. So this is the other sort of contribution. You will notice that, those were supposed to be the guidelines, but according to the WHO guidelines to draft guidelines, these guidelines could not be called guidelines. They could only be called expert consensus because the evidence base was so low that we couldn't even call it guidelines. So it's kind of a patchy thing. It's quite frustrating working on this, but we did it. So I'm not going to present for the fourth time around this. I'm sorry again, I clearly drew the short straw here. But this is to remind you that because humans are intermediate hosts, there's no parasitology test that can help us to diagnose echinococcosis in humans. There is no ovine parasite test. In other words, this is one of the few parasitic diseases where ovine and parasites are impossible. I mean, it doesn't even exist because the eggs are shed by the definitive host, that is the dog or other canids, whereas the cyst, which is the metacestod, i.e. the larval part of the larva stage of this helminth, only occur in the intermediate host, that is a sheep and for and us. So this is again, I'm always using this set of images that were kindly given to me by Professor Hans Seitz, now retired, a very good parasitologist in Bonn, Germany, and I wanted to remind you the structure of the cyst to put it in a clinical context. So this is a C1 cyst sitting on the diaphragm, and from top left to top right, the cyst has been taken out and put in a petri dish. And bottom left, you see, if you cut the cyst open, you see the clear fluid. This is a C1 cyst. And if you cut and open and you see the inner layer, the so-called germinal layer, you see all these whitish dots are either Bruch capsules or protoscolysis. And the point is that protoscolysis, seen again here in this cross-section, from each protoscolex, a new daughter vesicle can arise. And this gives you the visual of the anatomic potential for relapse and why it is so difficult for non-surgical techniques to treat in a definitive way this cyst. This is the germinal layer. It's a unicellular, very thin layer, and outside you have the multilaminated layer, which is an acellular layer that acts as a shield and as a filter, so to speak. And outside, you have the pericyst, which is the host tissue more or less compressed. This is another cross-section and shows you again the thinness of this germinal layer, from which here three broad capsules are seen, seen arising, with each with a number of invaginated protoscolices. So we, here we have the laminated layer, and this is the liver parenchyma. The other point is that when we scan a cyst, we only get a snapshot because echinococcal cysts are actually in a dynamic condition. They change over time, either spontaneously or as a result of non-surgical treatments. And here we have on the left, on the left end, you have a C3A cyst. That girl, a patient from Sicily, was given albendazole for several months, and in the middle you see the result, the outcome of these months of albendazole. The cyst is smaller, the endocyst is kind of thicker, and the fluid is also, there's less fluid. Now, this can happen spontaneously. At that point, we stopped albendazole, and the cyst sort of slided towards the inactive C4 stage. And this is to show you that actually you can spot on ultrasound, or if you're observe carefully the structure of the cyst even within the C4 cyst, because you can still see the folded endocyst and the space with the fluid that's been filled by this pseudocaseous inflammatory material. So this is what we believe, after decades of observation, to be the natural history of the cyst. On the upper row, you see the favorable outcome for us, the host. But the point is, from stage C3A and from stage C4, if something happens and the cyst reactivates, we have C2 respectively and C3B. And the problem with those stages is that there's almost no space for non-surgical treatment, meaning you can treat with albendazole or can treat with PEER and puncture each single daughter vesicle. But the problem is, when you stop albendazole or after you did PEER, new daughter vesicle will pop up. And this is going on forever. I mean, if you give more albendazole, the same happens 3 times, 4 times, et cetera. So there is no way out other than surgery. So why is it complex? Again, because diagnosis is based almost exclusively on imaging. Serology, to be honest, is of very little value, and there is no search for ova and parasites in the stools. So if you want to demonstrate that that cyst is 100% parasitic, you have to puncture the cyst. Okay. So the other problem is, because this is a poor man's condition, there's very little, if any, money for research, and therefore it's very difficult to set up even one randomized controlled trial. In actual fact, the trials that you will see in the literature are probably 5 or 6 tops. So this is where we stand. Serology is very little. It's of very little use, because when you would expect positive serology, you get negative serology on the left end, and on the right end, often when you have inactive cyst, serology is still positive. So this is really puzzling to some who are those who are inexperienced, and they sometimes end up treating serology and not treating the cyst, because the cyst is already inactive. So these are the 3 therapeutic options, and with the 4th management option called watch and wait, because after a long time we could show that for uncomplicated C4, C5 cyst, not touching them is the best management options, because there are no complications and there are very, very few reactivations. So I'll give you a short tour of the a number of key papers that were produced under the umbrella of WHO Informal Working Group. This is probably the most complete paper on the effect of benzimidazole derivatives. This is a systematic review showing that yes, 30% of cysts respond, but the point is not the rate. The point is that the cysts that do not respond are, again, C3B and C2. In other words, multivesiculated cysts do not respond to benzimidazole derivatives. This is, again, the booklet that is freely downloadable from the WHO website on so-called PEAR, which is the probably the percutaneous treatment that is better known. This is a paper where we show that actually dying from anaphylactic shock from puncture is less likely than dying from a shot of penicillin. And so I'm very happy to have produced this. And this is based on the structure of the cyst, where the attack point of various treatment pair aims at damaging or destroying the germinal layer. Albendazole, same thing. Other percutaneous treatments are basically large bore catheters that aim at sucking out the entire endocyst as opposed to destroying the germinal layer. And as the previous speakers have shown at length, radical surgery would is less laden with recurrences, but is also more let's say aggressive. Okay, so you take the pericyst out, whereas if for conservative surgery you take out the entire endocyst, which is the same aim as the other percutaneous treatment. So this is the first paper that we published on so-called watch and wait, very prudent, but I think very interesting, and we published some sort of an update recently in the American Journal of Tropical Medicine. So basically, again, if you are a ID or if you are a non-surgeon, what you want to avoid is the progression from here to here, and basically at this point you cannot prevent much, but this is where you can actually act successfully by choosing either albendazole, depending on the size of the cyst. If the cyst is less than 5 centimeters, then albendazole will work. If it's between 5 and 10, then we tend to use percutaneous treatments, and over 10, that is for giant cysts, probably continuous catheterization is the best method. Unfortunately, I did not bring any slides about those options because of the limited time, but I will be happy to talk to you if you have a question at the end of the session. So this is a summary of the various options based on stage. And I would say the bottom line is, over the years, we learned, as far as the liver is concerned, to use a stage-specific approach. I think this is the most valuable lessons. I want to, can I have another 30 seconds? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I want to, for those of you who are interested, okay, this is something we can discuss later, but there's a thing that has been set up during a 5-year project that we were participating in and funded by the European Union. This is the first time the CE community sees some real money, which is little money for the European community, but for us is a lot. And so we did this multi-center consortium, and we were able to set up a registry for CE cases, and you see the numbers as of end of July this year. And it was originally called the European Register for Cystic Echinococcosis, but it's clearly expanding outside Europe. And if any of you are interested in joining this initiative, you are most welcome, and I encourage you to participate to this international endeavor. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. I would ask our speakers to come and have a seat so we have time for a few questions. So we've had the chance to see different methods of approaching the problem, which is something rarely seen in the U.S., but much more so in other parts of the world, including medical treatment, talked about the staging and seeing the different types of surgery. Any questions from the audience? I would like to start. Dr. Schechter.
Yeah. Bill Schechter, thank you very much. That was an excellent presentation. Since I have absolutely no experience with disease, I have a couple of questions. Number one, if you choose to do the aspiration injection aspiration technique, must it always be done under laparoscopic guidance? And if it's not, how do you prevent leakage of the cyst after you take the needle out? That's question number one. And I have a second question is about the various sclerosing agents and other agents used to kill the scoliosis. How do you make the choice? And I noticed in Lebanon, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, somebody was using a high volume normal saline. I forget who the presenter was.
Hypertonic saline.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I thought it was normal saline. Okay, so I misunderstood. So I'll just ask my one question. How do you prevent leakage of the cyst fluid?
If I may answer. First of all, the PEAR technique where you aspirate, irrigate, and suck, this is done, can be done under laparoscopy, but most of the time it's done by our radiologist, so it's either CT or ultrasound guided. The thing is that this has to be repeated. It cannot be like terminated in one session. So they leave a drain and they go back and do it again. So it's a multiple sessions. This is one. Second, regarding the normal saline, what I mentioned is that after we finish the whole procedure, we irrigate the abdomen with normal saline to try to decrease the concentration of the scolecidial agent that we use. We use citramide.
Yeah, that was my misunderstanding. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you. Yes, please.
The albendazole, does it get into the cyst fluid or into the germinal layer, or exactly how does that work?
Good question. Thank you. Actually, we thought in the beginning that albendazole was going to be within the endocyst. Okay, it's very difficult to understand how it works in actual fact because we used to do PEAR, okay? We only do percutaneous aspiration plus albendazole now. So there's no danger of scolecidal agent, which in our case is alcohol, 95% alcohol, goes into the biliary trees. This is we just published last year this, and I'm sorry that I couldn't show it because, again, for reasons of time. Now, once we put a catheter inside the cyst, it was a C3A cyst, and you use what is called ultrasound contrast medium, okay? And the contrast medium remained for a long time between the pericyst and the endocyst. So we're not sure that albendazole goes inside the endocyst. But on the other hand, the endocyst, the folded membrane, is usually, because it's very thin, it leaks a lot. So sometimes you get fragments of it when you aspirate. So it is likely that albendazole in the fluid goes to the endocyst, the germinal layer. But no one really has a clear understanding of this, especially at the pharmacokinetics level.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Greg Jaron, I'm from Arizona, work with the Indian Health Service. We've actually had a few case reports out in the Southwest. So two questions. One, what would be the standard of care now? It sounds like, you know, I saw what you said about the state, you know, stage treatments. Would you go ahead and treat with mebendazole first? And that you mentioned about the ELISA antibody test, we were always, you know, my reading, you'd get the serology to see if it's actually a hydatid cyst first before you go ahead and
aspirate. I'm not sure I got the second question.
Oh, it seems like now the treatment is based on the stage of where you're at.
It should.
Yeah.
It's not.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, that's your point.
We see people treated with surgically with for 4 C4 and C5 cyst. Okay, this is very wrong, in my opinion, unless the cyst is complicated. If the cyst, you know, some patients realize that being harboring a cyst when they're in their 80s, and people scramble to treat that, but there's no need to treat them. Okay, so this is one very important point. Do not, if don't fix it if it ain't broken. This is number one. As for your first question was, when do you treat with albendazole?
Right, it sounded like it was the earlier stages.
Yes.
And then you see how they react to it.
The only stages that actually respond permanently to albendazole are C1 and C3A, the fluid-filled cyst. As soon as you have even a bunch of daughter vesicles, your chances to get definitive solidifications go down.
So then that's when surgery's
Probably, yes.
And is there any database or any attempt to collect data from the United States?
Well, we have some of you guys participating. One example is Dr. Coyle, Christina Coyle, in New York City. She is the cystic sarcosis queen, but also does its causing on the side, which is cystic echinococcosis. So we've been trying since at least 2008 to collect the U.S. cases. Another person was very much into, she's a veterinarian, but she's done a lot of work on CE, is Dr. Christine Budke, based in College Station, Texas, so near your state. And we would love to have cases from the United States, because this is why we are trying, the only way out of this mess is to try to systematically collect as much information. I mean meaningful information. You don't need to have 2,000 parameters. We need to have stage, presence of complication, size, which organ, et cetera, et cetera, and to have some kind of follow-up. That would be fantastic. So this is why we set up the Italian registry that became the European registry, and we hope it's going to be the international registry. So it would be nice to have the Americans on board.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Yes.
Can I ask you something that probably is in every American surgeon's mind? First of all, just to make it clear, what is the sensitivity and the specificity, well, not the sensitivity, the specificity of diagnosing hydatid cyst disease on CT scan and ultrasound? Just give us a number, more or less.
We're talking liver?
Yeah, liver.
If you were experienced?
Yes. Well, we're all inexperienced in the United States.
No, I mean, I'm not making it a national issue. I think experience meaning that you've really seen a lot of cases.
Is it in the order of 80%, you would say?
Higher.
Okay, 80 to 90. So yeah. So my question goes as follows. When we do CAT scans, now everybody has a CAT scan during their period of their lives. Most of us have about 20 during the period of our life. So we find cysts all over the place, right? Every time we do a CAT scan, we'll find cysts in the liver, and we label them as simple cysts, and we don't worry. What is the chance that in high-risk populations, for example, immigrant populations, these cysts represent echinococcal disease and they're not just simple fluid cysts and we should be pursuing them differently diagnostically?
Okay, this is why the room for CL was created in the classification. Okay, so basically it was put there because when you do mass screenings with ultrasound, you always find cysts, and sometimes you're not really sure those are parasitic cysts. So other than relying on imaging criteria based on your knowledge of the structure of the cyst, okay, because if you have, again, questions of time, I have tons of slides on the differentiation between non-parasitic and parasitic cysts, but basically it boils down to this. Look if there's any structure that reminds you of the structure of the cyst, meaning if it's a roundish
thicker wall,
black on ultrasound, anechoic cyst, then it can either be parasitic or non-parasitic, then at this point you should look for the double layer, because if you're lucky and you see the endocyst parallel to the pericyst, then you're looking at echinococcal cyst. If you're not, and your serology is confusing, you're left with what we do when we can really understand, we puncture the cyst and we look if there are protoscolices or not, and that's the end of the story. But you don't need that often. Okay, in the other cases, if you have the sagging endocyst, it's a kind of echinococcus. If there are multiple vesicles, and what you see, and if you look hard, what you see, there are not septation. The septae in the echinococcal cyst are really the walls of the daughter vesicles adjacent to one another. So you will see a double line if you look really hard and if you have a good insert.
One last question in the interest of...
I would just like to add something to Dr. Bermalo's question. Our radiologists classify in a very colloquial way if the cyst is clean or is dirty. If the
cyst
is dirty,
I'm with them.
Many times, people come to the city without an ultrasound. So if the cyst is, speaking about the liver, is dirty, ultrasound. And if there is high suspicion, serology. And that's the way we go.
Yeah, unfortunately, serology doesn't have much. That's the problem. Yeah, so you have to tread carefully with serology because you end up doing the wrong thing sometimes. So don't be too reliant on serology. But by and large, I totally agree.
This is the point of the surgery.
Yeah. So of course.
We refer the patient to the infection.
I think we have, please.
Thanks. We spoke a lot about careful operative technique to avoid intraperitoneal spread, intraperitoneal seeding, but we didn't speak at all about if it happens, how does it present, how often does it happen, and how do you treat it?
Can I just say a word like as a pre? That is why when you do surgery, I'm not sure these gentlemen agree with me, but I don't care if they don't. When you do surgery, when you puncture cyst, when you tamper with the cyst, you should cover with albendazole starting 4 hours before the procedure. Why 4 hours? Because then you have the the serum peak of albendazole. And should any protoscolysis hit the peritoneum because of the albendazole, this should prevent them from growing into new cysts, okay? So this is why it's extremely important to do prophylaxis of secondary echinococcosis when you do the liver or the abdomen?
Well, maybe just a quick answer to what happens in the OR.
Before the operation, we are giving the patient 1 week ago, we are starting to do albendazole. And protection of the area is very important, as you said. The recurrence rate is between the 3% or 9%, and 80% of them appear in the 2 years after the operation. And hypertonic.
The question was about secondary peritoneal echinococcosis.
How does it present, and what do you do?
You see cyst in the abdomen.
It depends on the clinic and location of the cyst. And if in this situation, if it is not so disseminated, you operate it also. And if it is operated,
it depends on the numbers. If yes. It's used and disseminated, you just gonna treat medically because you cannot go and remove them all.
How often do you see them? I mean,
I think in the interest of time, unfortunately, because we're over the time, we can discuss these questions with the panelists here. I want to thank all the panelists for their very useful and important contributions. I want to thank the audience for their participation.